How have you not seen this?
And welcome back to How Have You Not Seen This? As always, it's me, your host, Dustin Meadows. Today I am joined by my guest host, Taylor Reinhart.
Hi there.
And Satoya.
How you doing?
And we also have our guest, Chris Gross.
Heyo.
And Tim Myers.
Hey there.
And we just watched Pacific Rim.
Yeah, we did.
Guillermo del Toro's really fun summer blockbuster movie about robots fighting fucking monsters. Literally just an anime made live action. But super fun time, hated on by a lot of people because, oh, there's all these tropes, blah, 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 which, fuck you, tropes can be fun. So, Chris, how have you not seen this?
How have I not seen this? I did not see this in the first place because I'm like, I didn't really care for Transformers. I'm like, this is just another bullshit summer blockbuster dumbass action movie, which, sorry, Dustin, no, that's your thing.
Hey, that's all right.
But, you know, I decided not to see it, and then I had a buddy of mine tell me that it was fucking awesome, and now, after seeing it, I think, like, it's one of the biggest regrets of my life not seeing that in IMAX.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, if I could go back, I would.
Alright, Tim, how have you not seen this?
I think this movie came out around the time of, like, Battleship.
A bunch
of other really bad summer blockbusters that just looked boring.
Alien
and
monster
awful.
Fighting.
Yeah.
And this movie's called Pacific Rim, which is the most boring title of a movie ever. So I just kind of lumped it off as something that sort of belonged in that class of movies, but definitely pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. I think maybe you were talking earlier about how it just didn't do as well in the theaters, and I think, well, my initial reaction is, well, that's why, because people like us thought, oh, this is just bullshit. But usually that's the kind of thing that makes money.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's not really it. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. And I can't really say either. I was checking, like, it made double its budget back, but it was against the budget of just south of $200 million. So, like, I mean, it did decent, but it certainly didn't do, like, Avengers money or Dark Knight money or even the new Godzilla.
I think it was $400 globally, though, so I mean,
and usually, like, so, I mean, it didn't even do double, like, within the continental U.S., though.
Right.
It did better overseas than it did here, actually.
Yeah.
And that's how.
Listen, that's not very surprising.
Well, aren't only, like, Marvel movies making Avengers money these days? Is there anything?
the Marvel movies have done well. Like, I don't think any of them have set, like, the records that Avengers did when it came out, but they've all done very well.
Yeah, when asked about a sequel, Charlie Day said, well, I don't know if it's going to be possible because we don't have a cape. Superheroes are kind of in vogue right now. Big monsters, and certainly big fighting robots.
Yeah.
With real steel, as we talked about. It's sort of been maxed out in terms of its market.
Well, and the fourth Transformers movie is coming out this year as well.
Yeah.
So
maybe they'll mix it up. Maybe it'll be about something else.
Yeah. So, Chris, you clearly liked the movie.
I did.
You said you regretted seeing it in IMAX. Tim, what did you think?
I really liked the movie. My only complaint is the main character had no charisma.
Charlie Hunnam, just awful.
I
agree with you on that point. He's very vanilla, which I think is partially intentional, at least as far as the writing and the acting choice. Because the secondary characters are way like Herc, the Australian dad of those two, the run the striker. Jaeger, way more interesting.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Well, at the beginning, they did like that Han Solo reference.
Holy shit,
there's going to be a Han Solo fronted movie, and I got really excited, and then he just got more and more bland.
And then you're like, oh no, this is just Luke Skywalker for all of A New Hope. This is just, oh, I was going to go down to Anchorage and pick up some power converters.
Yeah,
I think it was very intentional. Like you said, the secondary characters, like Marshall, Herc.
Yes.
You know, everyone around him were almost these cult of personalities. Like, that's who you are. Like, that's who this character represents. And he was sort of supposed to be strong, silent, brooding type. It's like, oh, maybe he could have sort of the Batman charisma. No, he was just sort of... I'm a very cut dude who lost his older brother, and I'm sad.
Yeah, he's our legs.
I mean, like, it's the same with, like, Godzilla. Like, I don't... Like, you see,
with Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Other, like you see, like, a Tom Cruise-fronted blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
And he might not even necessarily play the most complex characters, but you just like
watching
Tom Cruise.
But he draws you in. Yeah, he certainly... He has a charisma about him.
I think this, much like Godzilla, was... I mean, not really about the characters. I will say Godzilla did have Bryan Cranston to, like, pull you in.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was not much about the characters.
Yeah,
this was actually, I thought that was more emotional than this than Godzilla, which I don't know how is possible.
Yeah, it's a lot more character driven, this movie.
Fights were very intense. So they had this weird intensity to them. So even when someone died, like, we got to see the groups, we got to see, like, the Russians, and then we got to see, you know, the Asians, and they just had these cool style moves, so to see their fight scenes, you would be like, I don't know much about
it. It served them for about 2 seconds.
And they were just annihilated. Yeah. That was a bummer. I was like, no, not the Asians. And then, like, the Russians, like, but they're tough, they're Russian, how are they going to die?
There's three action sequences in the entire movie.
Yeah.
You have the one at the very beginning.
Yep.
Which kind of, like, introduces it. Like, we have, like, all the backstory, which, like, I'll talk about that later. But, like, we've got that first action sequence with Gypsy Danger when his brother gets killed. Then that middle sequence, which is, like, 35 minutes long.
It's a scene.
Is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Guillermo del Toro does it in Blade 2.
Yeah.
When they go to the nightclub. That scene is over half an hour long.
It was so dope,
It keeps you in. And you don't see extended action sequences in movies.
Yeah.
And usually when they are, they're not done very well. But del Toro fucking knows what he's doing. And he can make a long, captivating action sequence. Like, we had those little intercuts, like, oh, here's Charlie Day being a goofball in an underground bunker.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, hey, they just whooped a fucking monster upside the head with a battleship.
It was very long, drawn out, but very, very intense the entire time. So there were ebbs and flows to the fight. It's like, so by the time they finally get the monster, you're like, fuck yeah. Because it was, for one, it was long, it was exhausting. You know, from a viewer's perspective, you're like, what is it going to take to kill? Oh, sword.
That impressed me. They pulled that out. It
felt like a Power Rangers call.
It was like, we're out of options. Like, no, there's one more.
Yeah.
And even Power Rangers, like, it's been, like, there's a very clear history of, like, with anime and stuff, like, of the monster versus robot genre. Like, obviously, you got things like Gundams. You got things like Power Rangers, things like, I'm not super familiar with anime, but I know that there's a shitload of it that is this. It's really cool to see it done, like, competently, engagingly, and just fun.
Yeah.
Like, this is so much fun. Like, Power Rangers, obviously, like, a lot of times you see it, it's corny.
Yeah.
And this is corny in parts, but it's more like a wink and nod.
Yes.
Like, it's not, like, bad because it's shitty. It's like saying, it's like, hey, we know this is kind of silly, but, you know, let's just stop pretending that everything has to be the Godfather or whatever.
Right. I thought the corniness was very appropriate, especially in certain instances, because I was like, oh, wow, that is like a manga. Like, that's exactly what a manga would sound like. But also, at the same time, certain things do have to be explained. Just the general... So I remember there was one scene... where Riley was like, I'm gonna burn this son of a bitch. But he had to kind of explain that, otherwise he just would have done something, it would have happened, and the viewer was like,
wait, what happened? Did he do that?
Right. So there has to be, like, there were certain parts where there just has to be this sort of cheesy over-explanation to catch everyone up, literally within 20 seconds.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that could have helped it was to give, like, Mako a little bit more meat, and they decided not to do that.
Which is unfortunate, because she's a fucking amazing character.
She's great, I wondered if there was, like, some sort of a language barrier for the actress, maybe? But, like, even that doesn't make too much sense. You can coach someone. I wish if their interplay had been a little bit less one-sided, it would have helped out a good amount.
That's a really interesting point, because she struck me as, like, almost a stereotypical subservient Asian woman in many respects throughout the film, which I tend not to get too nitpicky, but I actually found that troubling. There was a consistent bowing. Very much a waif in that regard.
See, I was reading a couple of things as we were watching the movie. One of the things, like, Del Toro said about picking her was like he intentionally he wanted like a female like lead up there, top build. Obviously, there's clearly like a love interest between her and Raleigh, but it's never explicit. Mm-hmm. Like they never hold hands. They never kiss or anything. Like they have that moment at the end where like she holds him because she thinks he's dead. And then, like, they smile, and that's it, though.
I appreciate
like,
that.
Like, yeah, and it's great. Like, because a lot of times, like, a love story is shoehorned in just for the sake of having it. Like, the first Hellboy movie, which Del Toro also did.
Yeah.
There's the love story between Hellboy, Ron Perlman, and some Blair's character, Liz Sherman, which exists in the comic books, but it feels so unnatural in the movie.
Forced.
And it's a bummer because, like, that's my only gripe with that first movie. Like, Del Toro, I think I've seen, like, 5 of his movies, and they've all been solid. He's a fucking amazing director, and he's gotten so much better when he's been allowed to have, like, a gigantic budget to do whatever he wants. Also, if he's listening, he needs to do Hellboy 3.
Pan's Labyrinth 2.
Well, so,
Pan's Labyrinth 2. The movie that needed a sequel.
No, I didn't want to address that, because I thought that was really interesting. I left the film thinking a lot about it. And, like, I think generally the film's problematic with what it does with Mako, but, like, there is this moment, so, like, the general thing that they do with, like, Japanese women, the stereotype that we have is like a very like virginal one, much a porcelain doll kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the first times we see her, she's just staring at Raleigh's abs and she's like, fuck yeah.
Yeah,
so that's,
yeah.
Like, that's
yeah.
like a little bit of a moment where they subvert like our stereotypes a little bit. And then she runs and hides in her room. Yeah, and then there's that problem.
Well, I think that was just them, you know, like you said, maybe that's them poking in on it, because she is, anytime he is shirtless, she's trying to see it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's
right.
multiple...
So there's, like,
yeah.
there's like a couple moments of subversion and, like, sexuality.
Oh, yeah,
cool.
She's very
and, like,
clearly a human female with,
human
physical
emotions.
Desires and everything.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for her to, like... break out against Idris.
Against
Stacker.
Stacker's
his name.
Stringer Bell.
Because Raleigh's always encouraging her to stand up to him.
Yeah.
I think that would be an incredible moment in, like, her and Stacker's relationship. Clearly have the paternal thing, but if she could, like,
see,
disobey
like,
him.
She even addresses that. She has that line. She says, it's not obedience, it's
respect.
Yeah. Which I think is, like, a very quick way, a very... like non-ham-fisted way for her to address that.
Yep. It's addressing it very quickly.
There's the whole scene where she first sees Stacker.
Yeah.
And he's like in like glowing light.
Yeah.
Which if it were anyone but Idris Elba would
like that
just
male
been
savior.
Painful to watch.
Yeah.
But it is a like a princess sort of moment.
Yeah.
And she's holding her shoe, like she could just put the shoe on.
There's very there's definitely I caught the shoe motif this time.
Yeah.
And I'll have to read up on it because I can't decode it. There's, I don't
know.
No, what's
there's some
Guillermo
meaning there, but...
brain. Yeah.
Yeah, there was the metal shoe at the end there.
Oh yeah, with Ron Perlman.
Yeah. He's got a lot of shoe stuff going on.
Yeah.
I think
like a Tarantino thing with feet.
Right.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there would ever be a moment where Mako's character would sort of strike out on her own, but I looked at that the dream sequence with her and the first time she saw the Marshal. I looked at that as sort of her now, because when Riley asked her, how many simulations have you done? So I've done 51 with 51 kills. Like,
yeah.
So she is a part of, if there were to be a new class, she would be leading that path.
Yeah, she's as capable as she can be without being field tested.
Exactly, but then you have a guy like Marshall, who was the first, who was among the first class, and as you can see, he's got the radiation poisoning, he's already dying as we speak, but he is the first of that class, done all these missions, they had all been successful. So I'm sure at the beginning it was probably like, aha, moment, but from what it sort of sounds like, she's like, look, I've done simulated battles as a person who's done battles, and he's also saved me and raised me, so there is an issue of respect here, on top of the fact that he's motherfucking magnificent Idris Elba. Like, it's,
God, he's so good at this.
He's just
so good at everything.
He's good at everything. Yeah.
I want him to be my own father figure.
Yeah.
I love my dad, but not.
Wait, him as a character or him as a person? Or him as.
Doesn't even matter. I feel like they emerge in my mind.
His part in The Office is emotionally compelling.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter what he touches.
And that was actually. That was the first time I saw him in anything.
Yeah, same as
The
Office.
I don't even remember that.
He wasn't on for an entire season.
He's on for a season
at least. He wasn't in for every single episode.
Right?
I think he leaves before the season finishes. But yeah, he's in for the bulk of it.
Right.
And his character is so much different It's almost this, you know, it's the opposite of Michael Scott, which is very, very strange for the dynamic of that show. But it totally works. Like, it's so good. It's so, he's just a very talented man.
Yeah, I'd love to see Idris Elba try to not play an authority figure.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if he could do it. Yeah, I know, I wouldn't know.
I think he absolutely could, but yeah, you, I mean, because, like, you, Stringer Bell in The Wire, even Heimdall in Thor. Like, such a small role. Like, he guards the bridge.
But you believe him. You believe him.
Oh, yeah, he's amazing.
He doesn't speak much, but, man, when he speaks, like, it's like, oh.
He doesn't even have, like, just that steely gaze.
Yeah.
Like, just, like, looks into your soul. It's just like, all right, this dude's in charge. this guy's calling the shots on the Bifrost Bridge.
Yeah, and he's the type of dude, like, he can walk out into the street, put his hand up in the middle of traffic, and people stop.
Literally, every car would stop.
Yeah, every car's like, wait, he might be he's an undercover, obviously. He's doing something. You know, but he just has that, it's not a silent charisma, it's just natural charisma. Whatever he does, you believe.
Yeah, he's fucking amazing. Yeah. We could do an entire episode just about Idris Elba.
But he's still just Stringer Bell in my mind.
Like, yeah, especially since we've been marathoning The Wire, the three of us, Tim, Chris, and I. Like, yeah, it's certainly hard for me to picture him as anything else now, because now that's what I have the most exposure to.
Have you caught him in Luther?
I have not seen Luther.
After
Luther is very good.
After
as well.
I see Luther, and he can do the things, man. That guy is a thespian.
Yeah.
Well, so I want to talk. You guys had mentioned being bored with the protagonist, which I think is fair. But I think that Del Toro here, like, finds a really good truth about action movies, and that's that, like, it's in the nuance and the things that aren't in the center of the frame that can make a film like this interesting.
Yeah.
And one of which I always like to talk about it is Hong Kong, you know, 15 years after the first kaiju has set foot. Is so cool. I mean, there's a whole borough of the city made inside the bones of a kaiju.
Yeah.
And that's not even talked about. Like, none of this is overt, but it looks so cool, and there's a black market in bone powder.
Yeah. Because
all these movies start with, like, it's like, you know, this new one, it's like Godzilla Begins, and, you know, there are all these, what we see for the first time.
Like, he's built a world
in the space of
the first half hour of the movie.
Yeah, and that's super cool. So the characters function that way, too, I think. I don't know.
That's also a Charlie Day fronted scene, so there was no room for me to roll my eyes.
Right.
That's actually one of the things that I love about that opening. Is, like, we get that voiceover narration from Charlie Hunnam's character, Raleigh Beckett, and it, instead of spending, I think we actually talked about this when we did Olympus of Swan, but, like, spending 40 minutes finding out, okay, we know this dipshit got bitten by a radioactive spider, just get to the good shit, like, in 3 minutes, we know exactly what's going on.
Yep.
We get, like, 5 years worth of history, and we're just thrown into the thick of it. Which I love, which is great. It was one of the things I liked about the Ed Norton Incredible Hulk movie, too, which I think I might have mentioned, where, like, it's just like, oh, hey, he got gamma radiation, he turns into a green rage monster.
Sure.
Here he is 2 years after all that's happened. No more backstory. You don't need it. There's no reason for this.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. I expected it to be very expository in the whole movie.
Yeah,
it was about the initial invasion.
Oh, you're going to see the Incredible Hulk an hour into the movie.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems I think that happens with a lot of action, especially a lot of comic book movies right now. There's, especially when you're restarting a franchise or just starting a franchise.
Yeah, you get weighed down in the origin.
Yeah, especially when you're rebooting a motherfucker. There is the need to... Here is the... When we know... Everyone knows how Spider-Man came to be. Everyone knows how Batman came to be, how Superman came to be. The need to constantly reboot it must be someone's fetish, because I don't think it must be a higher up's fetish, because I don't see how it's needed.
Yeah,
anymore.
Well, it's unfortunate, because there's so many more interesting stories you can tell than just where they came from.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what makes me kind of interested to see the next Superman film, because it already has a Batman who's established.
Yeah,
that who's like grizzled and been at it for like over 10 years. It was there.
Yeah,
it'll still take us an hour to see.
Oh, I'm sure.
I know. And
well, like with this movie, I would love to see more of Hannibal Chow's history, Ron Perlman's character. I would love to see, like, just how Charlie Day has progressed to the point he is.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I was reading. I actually think Del Toro did really cool. He's talking about Charlie Day's character, Dr. Gessler, and he wanted, like, this celebrity chef mentality for the character. and Charlie Day totally nails it.
Yeah.
Like down to, like, having the tattoos and, like, just, like, the attitude, like, Bern Gorman, like, his compatriot, so British, very proper, very scientific. And Charlie Day, like, It's like Venkman in Ghostbusters. Yeah. You're like, this guy is a scientist. Yeah. Like, this guy's super funny. Like, I would like hanging out with this guy. But this guy is also a gigantic fucking nerd. Yeah. Which I think is a really cool beat for that character. And then, especially Bernd Gorman, who also nails it in a completely different role.
Yeah.
And they mesh so well together.
I will say this, like, this is a cool thing they did in the movie, was, like, the whole, like, focus on, like, memories and stuff.
Yeah.
Which was not even necessary for the advancement of the plot, just sort of a cool subplot of how memory works. And there was that scene where the British guy and Charlie Day are driving together. I'm like, oh man, we're going to get to see glimpses of his childhood and like figure out like how he sort of developed. But I think you got more of the British. It's all very fast.
Yeah,
you don't get a lot of it.
What
to
you,
piece
you get
together.
The Charlie Day's character was. He, like, you see him talking about people, like, being kind of respected. And then Bernd Gorman, at one point, you see him as a child.
Yeah,
like,
just
like
out
well,
on the board,
and then you see,
yeah.
like, there's a shot where, like, he's, like, bent, like, in the corner, like, kneeled over, like, probably got picked on a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, like, 2 seconds. Like, and, like, most people, like, would get a monologue or some kind of explanation. It's like, no, in 2 seconds, they gave us a huge piece of Bernd Gorman's character's backstory.
That's very interesting that you brought that up, because there was a scene with Marshall and Herc's son.
Yeah.
And he was like, we haven't even drifted yet. He's like, dude, I have you pegged since day one. He's like, you're just an arrogant kid with daddy issues. He's like, you were simple to figure out. Which is very, very interesting, because he's like, no, I don't need to mind mess with you. I already know you, whereas in that scene where Charlie Day and Burr's character, where their mind meshed, you get what you get, and that's it.
Yeah.
It could have been, like you said, it could have been a whole monologue, could have been, no, that explains everything.
Yeah.
That explains almost everything you need to know. Like, I thought that was, I just made that connection. It's like almost the same thing.
That's Guillermo del Toro admitting that this is just a terrible character. Just even writing him off himself.
Well, but then Stacker has that follow-up line. He says all those things about him being an egotistical jerk with daddy issues, and then it's like, but you are your father's son.
Exactly.
So again, in the space of two lines, we know exactly how Stacker feels about him. And from like him picking a fight with Raleigh earlier, we know he's kind of a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
He's good at what he, but he's also good at what
he
does
what he
too.
Does. He's good,
and he'll do the job,
and he did. Like, he's like, yo, if you really, he'll do it. He'll talk a lot of shit, and he'll be an arrogant prick.
But
he's
at the end of the day, like he makes the sacrifice play.
Yep,
and I love too the big trope that pops up so much is that I don't like you, but goddamn, I respect you.
Yeah.
So, like, that pops up between, like, three different sets of characters over the course of the whole movie. And I always like seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the movie also sort of has this Watchmen theme of, like, you, like, trust has to be immediate. When the going gets tough, you have to fucking trust people. And, so I think the script's terseness really helps bring that out, because I think that's such a big thing about the drift, is, like, you have to just, you know, in relationships, whatever they may be, romantic.
Yeah.
And there's so many different relationships in these things. There's, like, romantic relationships and familial relationships, like brothers and also father and son relationships.
Yeah.
And all of them require absolute trust. You gotta dive
in.
And that's super interesting.
We joked about this last night. We were texting back and forth about this movie, you and I, Taylor, and I said something about the movie not having love, and you said something. This movie absolutely is about love.
Yeah.
Like, not necessarily romantic love, but, like, across the board, all kinds of it. And I think that's really interesting, because you wouldn't expect that in a movie with robots punching monsters.
It's actually less about likability and a lot about, are you capable? And that you're, like, love. Because brother, you know, parental, all that, you know, sexual even. A lot of it has to do with, okay, like, liking someone. Okay, that's nice. You can.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't even necessarily have to like the main character. You actually really don't. You don't have to, and yet you still had a fun time with it.
Yeah,
I can't not like him after the whooping that he gave Herc's son. I'm like, oh dude, that was
proper. Kicked him into the steam pipes.
Yeah.
That's the best part of Stacker's character though,
yeah.
is he never veers into like angry police chief.
Yeah.
Like, he's always respectful of everyone, even when they talk back to him, and he takes into account their criticisms.
Yep.
One of the best moments is when Raleigh's going off on him about grounding Mako, and Stacker says, well, like, I don't need your sympathy, I just need your compliance.
Yep.
And so he just, like, holds his ear and waits for him to say yes, sir.
He's like, well, I remember at first, I didn't get that. First time I saw it, I was like, wait, is he It's bleeding. I was like, he's going to bleed out of
blood out of every other orifice.
But then he showed, I need to hear that. Oh, word. Yeah, he listens to everything.
Yeah, there's two times he raises his voice in that entire movie. Yeah. And the first one is right after he dismisses Mako after Raleigh fights with Hark.
Yeah.
And then he says, like, don't confuse my calm demeanor for whatever, and then yells at
Mako's
coordinate. And then the other time is when he gives his, we're canceling the apocalypse speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, that speech, we talked about this.
I think it's so good.
It's 10 seconds long.
I heard some laughter. Did you guys laugh at it?
Well, there's always a little bit of laughter in it because it's always comes off as cliche because it's kind of like, you're kind of saying the same thing as you say in every similar speech, but it's the way you guys were more impressed with the way they said it, how he kept it concise, dragging it out, and making it this big thing. It was just like...
Yeah, you see it like Braveheart, Gladiator.
Right. You don't want it to be like that, right?
It's like this four-minute monologue that douchebags quote on their Facebook walls or whatever.
Yes,
he goes up there.
Messages.
He's like, hey, this is it. We're going to cancel the apocalypse.
Yeah.
I
did laugh because the phrase canceling the apocalypse
is
kind of lame, but he delivers it so well.
Yeah,
like, it took me.
And I think like those scenes exist entirely to show you what the stakes are.
Most
of the time it's running in front of brave men and telling them we're going to be brave and I'm brave for telling you to be brave and also I'm going to go be brave out there. And like that's all we really get.
Yeah.
But there's something... Like, Idris Elba's like, stakes are clear.
Yep.
We're gonna
Look, I don't have to tell you, you know the things, right? No, like, we're stopping this today.
There's an apocalypse, we're not gonna let it happen.
We're not gonna have it,
And I was, I think I was more snickering because I was like, oh god, here we go. And I was pleased that it didn't end up that
but
way.
But
you're waiting on that 4-minute monologue.
Yeah.
But I appreciate for any moment that was actually, you know, corny or cliche, I appreciate the fact that they went for it. They didn't half-ass it. They didn't, because sometimes you can tell it was like, oh, that's just kind of cheesy. They went for it.
Yeah.
It was like watching someone do musical theater, like doing the jazz hands. It is ridiculous, but you're going to make that, you're going to smile and you're going to do it and you're going to sell that point home because the minute you sell it, it's like, oh, that's cliche. But it's still kind of badass.
Yeah. So they all get their moments of badass.
Oh, yeah.
Which I appreciate. There's no, like, Porkins character.
Porkins.
Yeah.
Like, even though Naoko is pretty subservient, she does have her moments, like, bow fighting and stuff
that's a really good scene.
Where she gets
scene.
To, well, you know,
and
to
that, and that whole thing, too. Like, she's, like, and even when Idris Elba yells at her about more control, like, she's very calm throughout that entire thing.
Yeah.
Like, and every time like she lands up, like she doesn't gloat, she just like very, very quietly states what the new score is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think that's really cool.
Well, can we talk about the staff fighting?
Yeah.
That was just not at all necessary, but everyone likes a good staff fighting scene.
Yeah. Right.
So just throw
well,
it
it's
in
like Erica had commented on this in Batman Begins when they're fighting with the swords. She was like, "What bearing does this have on the final mission?" Yeah. And that's the bow fighting. It's like, you know, you're not using a bow to fight bow staff. It's not gonna happen.
It progresses in the same way as every one of those, where it's like you just tap them right away first, and the fights get more and more complex.
Yeah.
Well, at least they were doing hand to hand combat technically in the
Jaegers.
They weren't using buttons,
so a lot of it looked to be reactionary. If it could serve any purpose, a lot of it looked to be like, okay, what's your reaction time? What's your whatever? And at the same time, let's just fucking fight because that's what it is.
Right.
Like, I got 2 hours. Let's fight. Let's have a fight.
Yeah, we got another 45 minutes before we punch monsters.
Right. We can't decide
eating corn nuts out of a tin or whatever.
God,
I would watch Idris. I watched Prometheus. When I saw Prometheus, Idris Elba was still like the best part of the thing.
Oh yeah, well,
and I actually liked that movie.
Oh,
I did. It was
conversation
bad.
For another time.
It was bad, but I liked it. But Idris Elba was still like, dude, I'm gonna watch it because Idris is in this.
That is far too considerate for that movie.
I'm a considerate guy.
Oh god, that movie is just a train wreck of stupidity.
So
it is. I'm not denying it, but I'll watch it if it's on. Like it is.
Yeah, one of the problems with we've watched a lot of action movies in a row. I've been on this podcast. This is my fifth time in like 2 weeks.
Oh yeah, fifth time in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's a lot. And every single time I've been called in for a fun action movie, and I like it, but I think that, like, you need to get, like, Lost in Translation next or something. And there is a
That'll
really cool...
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I actually haven't either.
So. Oh, what?
You gotta be in the right mood to see that movie.
Oh,
it's really boring.
Well,
so
watch a sad one that makes you think, what am I doing with my life?
Look, I'm gonna tell you right now, unless Lost in Translation... Like, I know some things about it. Like, I know that it ends... with Bill Murray whispering in Scarlett Johansson's ear, unless he whispers Hell Hydra, I don't give a shit.
So I think there's like this really good, I mentioned it because I think there's this really good Lost in Translation moment where Mako says something to Idris Elba and they don't translate
yep.
it.
And I thought that was perfect. I remember
so cool.
that. I was like, yes.
It's so
yeah.
cool.
Yeah,
that
because,
really good.
Because
I'd love
that
to know
was
what
for
she
them.
Said.
Yeah. That was for them.
Yeah, yeah. As it was definitely like not for, because there's so many moments in it that are for the American audience. Hell,
yep.
Charlie Hamill's whole character is
yeah,
for the
yeah.
American audience. But like that moment is like something different, and that's really cool. Yeah, I don't want to know what it was,
nope.
and that's the same
I'll never look it up.
Translation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will never look it up because it's like okay,
yeah,
you don't
need to know.
You don't
yeah.
know, but you know.
Yeah,
exactly. You know what I'm saying? Like
you got the
know,
context, you got the yeah.
the amount of respect you're showing Idris Elba.
Okay, first of all, like Idris Elba said, let's make two things perfectly clear. One, you never touch him. Okay.
Yeah.
Number two, you never touch him. Yeah. Okay? You do not disrespect the Idris. You don't all do right, it.
All right. You got to choose. Marry, fuck, kill.
Oh, in
Angela Bassett, Cole Hauser, Idris Elba.
Okay.
Because two episodes you've done,
yep.
you are a very vocal fan of all.
Okay. Now I'm gonna. Okay. I'm gonna marry Idris Elba.
Okay.
Oh.
I'm gonna fuck Angela Bassett.
Oh no.
Yeah. And then I'm gonna kill Cole Hauser because everyone kills Cole Hauser. Everyone kills him. I'm not happy about it, but it'll be respectful. It'll be a good.
You had a chance to break the cycle and you didn't.
I couldn't. What chance is there?
The greatest evil good men can do is nothing.
Okay, first of all, I can't just go on killing Idris Elba because he dies a lot and stuff too. Let's not be mistaken.
True.
Although he has like more badass deaths that you never really get to see, but he's always self-sacrificing.
Cole Hauser is literally nothing but death.
Yeah, he's literally nothing but getting shot.
Cole Hauser is American Sean Bean.
Exactly. So yeah, it's actually really true. Oh, so that, hey, Cole, good news, man. You got an HBO sitcom coming. You're going to die in the first 8 episodes, dude. You're going to do really well. Hey, keep your head up.
Can someone make a movie where Satoyo has to kill Cole with tears in his eyes? Just like,
I never wanted it to come to this. The movie is an hour and a half long, and it's just Satoyo standing over him, rationalizing and explaining the amount of respect that he has for Cole Hauser.
I think we can totally do this.
Meanwhile, Idris Elba sits in the back just eating nuts.
eating corn nuts.
Every 10 minutes, like, we'll cut to some B-roll of that for a couple of minutes.
It'll be great. It'll be good, yeah, but that's my fucking
And
miracle.
Then, like, at an hour and 20 minutes, Idris Elba just says, do it.
That's it. Actually,
yeah.
then I'd shoot him.
Yeah,
then I would shoot him. Then, of course, I'd have a proper funeral service for this man.
Right.
Okay.
Then I just walk in. Hey, yo, String, where's Hauser? String, where's Hauser? Where's Hauser, String?
And it's actually the precursor to The Wire. It was the prequel to The Wire the entire time.
And then Tim Myers joked that he would get a dog and name it Avon Barksdale.
Yeah.
So the bulldog from Pacific Rim barks. Tim says Avon Barksdale. And then credits.
I'm sure that's what the sequel will be.
That'll
do it.
Yeah, that's gonna be the sequel.
I like very earlier one of the first episodes of the podcast. Somebody was giving me grief for having not seen The Wire, and now 30 some episodes in, I can finally talk about The Wire on this podcast.
And one day you'll be able to give people grief for not watching The Wire.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I think white people have given enough people grief
yeah.
about not having seen The Wire.
I think white people need to continue giving other white people grief about things that black people are doing. I think they need to continue the grief, like, because it's their guilt, whatever. Now I've got to deal with it. Keep doing it. You're doing a good job.
I think that's fair, but... I think we all know that sometimes white people are just annoying.
Yeah, it's a bit much. This film...
But although I would much rather get pestered about The Wire than Kale or whatever.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
So I get it.
Like Basil or something.
It's enough to make you conservative after a while. So like, I get
it
now.
White people being annoying, I went to this with some nerdy friends that I met at an internship, and they wouldn't stop talking about this movie to the point where it almost annoyed me.
Almost took you off.
They were, yeah, they're great guys, huge nerds, significantly more so than me.
Yeah.
And I'm a pretty big nerd, so, like, they, yeah, I couldn't, eventually, the sword thing, I was like, yeah, it was cool, but let's let this go. This is one of those movies that nerds grabbed onto and held onto very tight. I'm glad Godzilla came to shut them up.
Well, yeah. Did you listen to the first half hour of us talking about this, just gushing about what
I know.
It is to
well,
be a hero?
And you, I, right, and so the first 10 minutes I'm silently thinking, fuck, I'm with my internship friend.
Well, you know what's so interesting? I totally missed the boat on the nerddom of it, and I think probably because of where I am geographically, like in Philadelphia and the part of Philly that I'm in, it's either just yuppies or rough people. They don't really give a fuck.
Yeah.
So I missed the boat entirely. So I was just home. I was just home in my apartment and it was on HBO one day. And I was like, okay, well, it's got Idris. Let's see it. Yeah. So that's why that's how it actually happened. And I'm so glad that I didn't have to deal with
it.
Yeah,
that's a great way to see it.
I would have hated to because this film I think was so fun to me that if you do a sequel, great. If you don't, okay. Because as a standalone, it's still good, I think. Because it still gets it all out the way. It finishes up, it gives you beginning, middle, and end, whatever else. If you make a sequel, cool. If not, cool. But, yeah, I totally missed the whole nerd boat, man. And I'm kind of glad that I did, because it sounds like it was intense.
Yeah, you have to kind of come into it on your own. Which, yeah, I mean, it's still the reason I haven't watched Doctor Who yet. Because 90% of the people I meet who like Doctor Who are way too intense for me.
What's your favorite Doctor? I had a girl.
How do you start?
Yeah.
What do you mean, how do you start?
There's so many of them. There's so many
characters. No, you start with Christopher Eccleston in 2005 and you go from there.
I had a girl.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Chris is one of them.
I'm sorry.
Chris is actually in the 10% of people who are bearable about it.
Okay.
It's true. I only have one TARDIS shirt.
Yeah.
That's good. I went on a date with a girl who judged me based on the fact that I had never seen Doctor Who. And she, like, judged me negative. It was a bone of contention for her. This was back when I was living in Columbus and went to the bubble tea spot here off of Ackerman.
That was your first mistake.
Yeah, well...
Dango or bubble tea?
First of all, I didn't like her that much.
Right, that's true.
But I respected her enough.
God damn it,
see, that's the thing. It's about
full circle.
It's about respect, you see. It's not about likability. Okay, I've had sex with women that I haven't liked. I've done it, okay, but I've respected them. That's the key. I like seeing Laura just, and I did that just so I could see her reaction. Like, see her shake her head. I did it. And I meant, because, guys, that's the thing. Respect is what we're missing in this country. Okay?
Can we talk about
and who doesn't caring? Like bubble tea, for the record? Wait.
Did you tell the girl that it was okay that you didn't like Doctor Who because look how fucking handsome you are?
No, I should have.
You absolutely should.
I should have.
Like, hey, do you think that a young black man like myself gets put this well together on accident? No. You're with this right now, and you're going to give me shit because I haven't watched a fucking BBC television series?
The rest of us have to stress out about not
seeing it. Well, I got to rely entirely on my personality.
Right.
It's the worst.
You know, it was funny, actually. She said that to me, and I just totally disengaged from the encounter because she made it a thing, and I was like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
I've got my bubble tea. Fuck you. Whatever. Yeah, I was happy. I was like,
yeah, your bubble tea.
You know it's a problem when you're sinking into your bubble tea.
I find bubble tea cathartic. First of all, I do the jelly, not the actual bubbles.
This is where I retreat to, and then I draw Mr. and Mrs. Satoyo over and over again. Who would take whose day?
Oh, I mean, clearly. You know.
Throw tapioca balls at the wedding.
This is fun.
Tim, what were you going
to
say?
Oh, I kind of shoehorned it in later. So I was just saying there's such pressure to have to see all these shows.
Yeah.
But, like, if I say I don't really like Lost, like, I get so much shit for it.
Mm-hmm. I honestly
just had to bite back yelling at you. I know how it is, but, like, I haven't seen shit. There's so much shit I haven't seen.
I honestly, as a person who's seen and enjoyed Lost, I don't feel the need to call it on people.
It's a soap opera. It is a soap opera.
That's how it always seemed to be. I never watched
it. It's sci-fi soap opera.
And it got very muddy towards the end.
It gets murky in a couple of different points. A lot of people were very split on the ending. I think it could have ended far worse than it did.
Yeah,
I didn't mind the ending, but, like,
yeah.
I've also come across it, like, three different times. Like, it's in my Netflix queue, and I'm like, I don't know, I got too many other things to watch.
It's very funny. Like, so we all commit the same amount of time to watch every episode of Lost. It's every episode of Lost. But at the same time, I did it in like 3 months.
Yeah.
And so for people who did this for 6 years and obsessed.
Yeah, I marathoned the first 3 seasons of it over the course of a couple of weeks. And then I think I had to catch up on the first few episodes of season 4. And then I only watched like the last 2.5 seasons live.
Right.
And that was... That was torture.
That's the thing about this nerd culture is you can do it in a way that also is not very time consuming by just waiting until everything's done and then
that's what I always do.
It's a great way to do it, but also, yeah, still not, if we're talking about nerd purity, like, it's still not very pure to watch something distilled in 2 months.
But it's like a codependent relationship with a show like Lost. Like, it's all, like,
isn't that part of nerd purity?
Yeah.
Isn't that part of nerd purity?
But you're just an addict. You're just a nerd addict.
I think sometimes it works backwards, though. Like, if you're waiting for something to come out every week and you're really, really, like, dedicated to it, I can see that really getting you sucked into it and really making you, like, a huge fan. But for me, there are a few shows where I've been binge-watched them, and it has, like, turned me into a super fan because it's like you can't stop doing it over and over
again. I watched the first 4 seasons of... The first 4 seasons of Breaking Bad that way. I marathoned them all together, and then I watched the last 2 seasons live as they aired, and I think it would have been better to watch that. Like, I don't know. Like, that show puts me on... Like, that show gives me near panic attacks anyway. Yes.
Yeah. And I couldn't stop watching. That's nerd codependency.
AV Club actually did a write-up like a year ago about, like, binge-watching a television program as opposed to experiencing the way, like, it's intended, like, on a weekly basis for however many months a year and everything. So it's interesting. Yeah, it's just interesting to kind of, like, see. Some shows it works with. Like, you could marathon Archer over a week, and that's totally fine because it's a different beast. But then a show like Breaking Bad or like Mad Men or Lost or The Wire even, it's a different sensation there too.
My friend Logan, he writes for Frontier Psychiatrist. He wrote an article about binge watching Breaking Bad and how that's not a good show to binge watch because Breaking Bad has a lot of patterns with the characters. Like, they don't evolve over time. Like, a show like The Wire is very much built for binge-watching because there's so many themes, the characters change. But Breaking Bad, Jesse and Heisenberg have the same relationship throughout, and they fall in the same patterns.
It just gets worse over the period.
Right, whereas The Wire is more of this organic, it's a more organic sort of beast because The Wire is more about Baltimore than West Baltimore than it is about any particular character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like The Wire, mostly when people are watching The Wire, they're watching West Baltimore because they've never been to West Baltimore.
Yeah.
So you're going to see Kings come, you're going to see Kings go, you're going to see Kings ascend again. Like it's all those things.
Yeah.
But it's very, I think almost. It's very weird. Game of Thrones is a thing that I watch now, and I try not to get too much into the nerdiness of it, but I like the fact that I'm watching it as it's happening.
Yeah.
Because I can now... Because now I've got... the Red Viper is going to fight the Mountain on Sunday. You know, that's a real...
Yeah.
Oberyn Martell is going to take on Gregor Clegane,
and
it's going to be for the freedom of Tyrion Lannister. There are a lot... But I've had to, it's fucking ridiculous.
It takes a victory sip of bubble tea.
Yes,
no one can see my silent laugh.
But I have had to.
They just all assume.
But I can appreciate the weight of that, the anticipation of that, and I've binge watched things. But also at the same time, it's harder now to binge watch because we have shit to do. You know, so sometimes like I want to binge watch. Oh, I should probably go get good at this thing. You know, like that. You know.
Also, there's even one more layer. So, like, we're talking about, like, binge-watching versus watching as it's intended. That's still a period of 6 years. So, like, my dad gave me a Batman comic when I was 4.
Yeah.
So I started watching the animated series at 5.
Yeah.
So, like, that character has evolved with me over the course of my life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's something that we miss out in this binge-watching thing as well. And that's something we miss out with all of these characters. And, you know, I mean, like, Catcher in the Rye is an important book to me. That's cliche, but, like, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I've read it at different points in my life, and it's meant different things.
Yeah,
there's so many different works of art and fiction and nonfiction even that can do that. And we don't do that now. We watch one thing, and we're like, okay... That's now added to my pop culture cachet.
That's totally it.
Yeah.
You people watch it now to be in a conversation, to not be excluded from the conversation, to write about it, talk about, blog about it, make a YouTube video about
podcast.
It's literally watching these shows. just to be able to say, yeah, I watched that too.
Yeah.
To be pop culturally relevant and up to date.
That's the problem with TV shows, is writers go into making these TV shows without a clear end in mind.
Sure.
Like, especially a show like Lost. Like, that was just improvised.
Yeah.
And you can tell.
Yeah.
Fuck me.
Yeah. And, like, you get a work like Catcher of the Rye, like, that's a holistic vision.
Right.
And you don't really get that with TV shows.
Right.
Which is a problem
with
Breaking
Bad,
too.
Maybe The Wire.
Yeah,
that one, I mean, that one's pretty
good. I mean, that's, like, the most novelistic show.
Right.
It's
and that's what they shot for.
The most ambitious show.
Yeah.
Cool. We're Bring It Back. seriously, though, that was... some good talking points, so I'm totally cool with it going in either directions, or I wouldn't mind it.
Of course.
So Pacific Rim.
We did this last time. I think I'm going to do this to wrap up shows now because I got late. Like, I want to go around, just get what everyone's favorite thing about this movie was, or like their favorite moment. So Taylor, we'll start with you.
I think my actual favorite moment is the whatever Mako says to Idris Elba's character.
Okay.
And I think that my favorite sequence is the memory sequence when Charlie Hamill is back in Mako's like. Memory of the first time she encountered as a girl. And just because I really like scenes where, like, the past is haunted by the future, I just think it's a really cool theme. And it's a trope, but, like, it's one that
it's done really
so
well
here.
Yeah.
And it's spelled out explicitly in the movie.
Yeah.
This is a memory!
Yeah, that was very irritating. But at the same time, there's something really beautiful about the future staring back in the past. And, all of the, like, the fears and the emotions of the past now examined from a really... dispassionate future. I just always really love that. So that's my favorite scene.
Okay.
I would say my favorite scene would also be Mako's last words. Mako's last words to really Marshall. I really like that because I didn't know, and I don't really care to know. My favorite sequence would be the fight scene between Raleigh and Herc's son. Simply because I knew that I was supposed to dislike Herc's son, and I just did a whole lot, and I felt that was the first scene where really he sort of got, not only did he get put in his place, but he showed he could take it.
Sort
of took the whooping. He really wanted to win. He could not. He took the whooping, and it actually showed that he had strength of character. He just wasn't a douche to be a douche. Like, when it came time...
You didn't like him, but goddamn it, you respected him.
I like him. I was like, that man... He'll die for the cause.
Yeah.
He won't die just because, you see.
Chris? I'm going to say something unexpected and say this is going to sound really weird to say. My favorite parts of the movie were actually not the fight sequences. And what I mean by that is the fight sequences are awesome, and it's why I saw it. And they were awesome, and the child in me and the nerd in me wants those to be the best part. But what I really liked was that wasn't all there was to it. Like, there was actually a story. Like, we just watched Godzilla, and the... fight sequences are really good, and the acting wasn't terrible, but I didn't really take much away from it as far as the personal story went.
Yeah, it wasn't, like, as character-driven.
You know, and so, since I generally avoid summer blockbusters for that reason, because they're just all about the big action sequences, I appreciate that there was actually way more to it than I thought there was going to be.
Yeah.
I expected this to be a kick-ass monster-fighting movie, and for the acting to be terrible, and for the characters to be wooden, and for there to be nothing else there. And I actually enjoyed that there was a good story.
Was there a favorite moment in particular where you just sort of like an aha, that's really cool?
Well, most of the aha moments were like fight scenes where here comes the sword, here comes the, what was it? I don't even know. But yeah, no, I didn't have a lot of those intense moments during the personal character driven scenes.
Yeah.
But anytime they busted out something new in the during the fight scenes.
Yeah.
I'd be like,
Cool, Tim?
This is sort of a different answer, too, but I think the coolest part of the movie was sort of the aesthetics.
Yeah.
Like, the colors, like, the weird
colors
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then that scene right at the end where they, like, come crashing down to Earth, they come up in the pods, and it's just sunshine, blue sky, and it's so jarring because you've been in this nighttime color universe, and suddenly it's the daytime, and
it's
you're just blown away.
Yeah, it's the first scene in the movie that looks like real life.
Yeah.
Which is really
that's a good
cool.
point.
Absolutely true.
Really good.
Yeah.
So that's just my favorite aspect.
Cool.
Yes.
That's solid. For me, I honestly, I love Charlie Day and Ron Perlman in this movie. I am so disappointed that there weren't more with their characters because I thought they both fucking knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And Ron Perlman, of course, is a Del Toro regular Hellboy. He's great in Blade 2.
He is.
In this. And I actually, when I saw this in theaters, I didn't know about that little mid-credit scene of him coming out. So I was like, oh, Perlman was this really cool character, and he's dead now. And then I found out about it after, so this is actually the first time that I saw that scene. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I hope they make another one now, because Ron Perlman and Charlie Day can be there. But yeah, like a lot of the other stuff gets praised. And they were great. And I was actually reading another thing. Del Toro said the reason he wanted Charlie Day was because he was watching an episode of It's Always Sunny, and it's one where Charlie comes out of the basement, like, after he's had to go down, like, doing rat killing, and he's just talking about, like, killing rats and, like, just doing the Charlie work. And just, like, that they're, like, it's clearly a funny scene.
Yeah.
But there's also, like a gravity to all the things that Charlie is saying.
Certainly a passion. I mean,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
He's never this passionate.
Yeah. Well, it's like the same reason that, like, Brad Bird wanted Patton Oswalt for Ratatouille. Like, he heard his stand-up, and he heard, like, how passionate it was about, the, like, these things he loved. He was like, who should be the voice of a rat who has an appreciation for finer foods and cooking? Yeah. Oh, Patton Oswalt. That makes sense. So, yeah, Ron Perlman and Charlie Day, definitely my favorite parts in this movie. And again, like, that's amid a movie full of wonderful things, like Idris Elba. Rico Kikuchi, who was Mako. Yeah. Fucking phenomenal in this movie.
Clifton Collins.
Yeah, Clifton Collins, very good. Yeah. As, like, their coordinator or whatever he was. But yeah, I would love to see a sequel, especially because I think it'd be nice. We talked about it, like, how Rinko Kikuchi didn't get as much to work with as she could have, and she was very good in the role.
Yeah.
So, like, next time it'd definitely be nice to see her given a little bit more to play with.
Right, and they certainly nuked the leaders of this alien organization.
Oh, it's so good.
But, like, they've colonized a lot of places. We picked a fight with the wrong people.
Yeah.
We're one planet with a single robot. No, we detonated our single robot.
Yeah, we did.
We have no robots.
All the robots are gone.
Not mentioning the rest of their planet.
Right.
Which is part of their planet.
Yeah, humans have like 5 years, and then they
absolutely build another. They're going to build another one. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you'll get Pacific Rim in space, Chris.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where we can get
the asteroid belts.
Atlantic
Rim. Asteroid Rim.
Asteroid Rim.
Cool. I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you, Taylor and Satoyo, for co-hosting this with me.
No problem.
Thank you, Chris and Tim, for being my guests.
Yep. Thank you.
And we'll catch you all next time.
Join me next week when I'm joined by co-host Sumak Torgalkar as we take Jackie Manti through Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Make sure that you like the page on Facebook, or how have you not seen this? Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a review if you feel the need to. It helps drive up our traffic. And send any comments, questions, suggestions for the show to howhaveyounotseenthispodcast@gmail.com. And we'll catch you next time.